This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The presidential election is just months away, and Florida is expected to play a key role in deciding the next president of the United States. WMFE has teamed up with WUSF Public Media in Tampa to bring you coverage of the issues that are important to residents along the I-4 corridor, in a collaboration we're calling I-4 Votes. To get a sense of what matters to voters, we conducted an informal survey online and in person. And over the past few weeks, our reporters have been using the information we collected to report on some of the issues that matter most to people as they prepare to vote, including healthcare, the environment, immigration, and guns. So joining me are Mary Shedden. She is the news director with WUSF. Thanks for being here, Mary.
Sure, thank you.
Also joined by WUSF's political reporter, Steve Newborn. Steve, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And 90.7's Abe Abariah. Abe, thank you too.
Thank you.
So, Mary, tell us a little bit about the survey. How did this start? Because it wasn't just online. You also had a kind of an in-person element to it. What was going on there?
So we put together this survey, a set of questions that was maybe 8 pages long if you had to print it out on paper. And we asked questions about what were the top issues in the national political scene to you, what mattered most to you in the national scene, as well as what were your top economic issues, because we all know money matters to all of us. And we did this online. We started in October, and it went through December 31st, if I remember correctly. And we did reached out in the WSF community and at WMFE in the community as well. At WSF, we did travel out to some public events. We went to street festivals, an Oktoberfest, as well as even an African-American church in St. Petersburg.
And Abe, if I could bring you into this conversation, you've had a little bit of experience in sort of designing this kind of outreach to story sources in the course of your reporting with ProPublica. You kind of used that information to inform building the survey and then getting it out in the community, right? How did that work?
One of the things that we've learned in previous reporting is that, you know, you definitely want to make sure that when you're talking to people that you're kind of meeting them where they're at. And so, you know, we wanted to make sure that the survey was sort of hitting on the big issues, that we weren't missing anything or leaving anything out. And then that we were, you know, trying to target this to as many voters as we could along the I-4 corridor because of how important, you know, this particular stretch of the state really is when it comes to presidential electoral politics. You know, just broadly speaking, you've got, you know, North Florida that tends to lean more conservative. And then as you get below the I-4 corridor to the south, you tend to lean more progressive or to the left. And, you know, the I-4 corridor kind of ends up being the switch on that and the deciding factor. So, you know, we definitely made sure that we were, you know, trying to make sure we hit all the issues and then trying to target people as well. You know, we made a conscious effort to try and reach out to people who were voters that had some success, didn't really go as well as we'd liked. And we ended up just doing, you know, spending some money on Facebook advertising to try and reach people who maybe were not the traditional public media audience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were not as successful as I would have liked to have been, but we were able to get a broad swath of people. We had more than 800 people who were able to finish the survey. The majority of them were willing to be talked to by reporters after the fact, and we've certainly taken advantage of that in the last few weeks to reach out and talk to people and get a little bit more in depth into why, you know, they take one issue as their main issue or their second or third issue. And you know, the overall respondents ended up being female, ended up being older, well-educated, Democratic. But we did make sure that we ended up having a good swath, even though we were kind of skewed.
Right. So not a scientific survey, it's important to note, but definitely an interesting kind of tally of what the community is feeling. Mary Shedden, what were some of the issues to bubble up? Because we really wanted to take the approach that this isn't about the candidates. This is really trying to gauge what people are going into the ballot box thinking about in terms of issues, what things are important to them as they prepare to vote. What came up?
Well, the top two issues, without a doubt, was healthcare. And I think healthcare cost, the ability to get insurance, things like that, Medicare and Medicaid, but also the environment. And I don't think that's a huge surprise to those of us who live in Florida that it that the environment is a constant issue that we're talking about, whether it's sea level rise or the effect of growth on our environment. So while those weren't surprising, it was validating that this this snapshot of what our community felt was nice, because this gave us a chance to not assume what people thought was important, but instead we heard what people thought was important.
Right. And it's interesting to listen to the voices of some of those voters. For example, the folks that Julio Ochoa spoke to in his story about healthcare. And there's a real kind of tug of war going on around issues like, you know, should single-payer healthcare be something that people vote on? Is that even going to be achievable, whoever becomes president, if a Democrat is elected, and if that's the policy they're running on? Were there some surprises in that, in the reporting that came out of that particular angle of the story?
I think what was most interesting about the healthcare reporting is how sincere and in-depth the individuals are thinking about these issues when it comes to healthcare. Sometimes I think you hear terms like single payer or Medicaid or Medicare for all, and they're just catchphrases. But it was very clear that the people that Julio had an opportunity to speak with, they had thought about these issues, they were educated about it, and they knew how it applied to their lives. In particular, there was one woman who spoke about, she's on Medicare and she has a great Medicare Advantage plan. She doesn't worry about herself, but her daughter has an Obamacare plan and her granddaughter is on Medicaid. And every moment, you know, she's thinking about what it means to them to have better health care. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, that was the ultimate goal of this survey, is to get those real stories that those of you listening can identify with. You know, we want to make you hear your neighbors and hear what your neighbors are thinking about those issues.
Steve Newborn, this is not your first presidential election. You've been covering politics for a long time in the Sunshine State. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this new approach, trying to take a more sort of ground-up approach to the reporting and really sort of put it voter first rather than focusing so much on the candidates. How's that experience been for you?
Yeah, right. I think the genesis for this whole I4 votes came about 4 years ago during the last presidential election. A lot of the national media and the pundits didn't see the Trump tidal wave washing over America. And I think that's because they didn't get out in the community and they trusted polls too much. So, you know, this is more of a survey. This isn't a scientific poll. Polls have their own, you know, problems with how they're collected and such. But the idea here is to get away from all that, get away from the talking heads, talk to people directly on the ground and see what they think. And it's amazing what you'll hear out there that you won't hear, you know, watching the cable TV shows going 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Mary, just sort of pulling out a little bit and taking a sort of 30,000-foot view, I mean, aside from getting those voter voices in, there are some other imperatives in covering the story of the election, the 2020 election, in the way that we're doing, not only partnering up these two stations on either end of the I-4 corridor, which is such an important area and so decisive, potentially so decisive in this election, also as far as kind of trying to reframe the narrative of how people respond to journalism and respond to reporters, right? Just talk a little bit, if you could, about the need to rebuild trust in the media in some regards.
Sure. Many of us in the media really have seen the erosion of trust over the last couple of years. 2016 really was a time when reporters going out, you are seeing much more often somebody not wanting to talk to you, not wanting to trust you. And the evidence is there that they don't, the Americans don't trust the media. A Gallup poll in 2019 showed that less than half of all Americans really have faith in what journalists are doing. This is putting the capital M in media with television, newspapers, and radio. If you look at it from a partisan standpoint, it's even more profound. In the poll, 69% of Democrats said they had confidence in the media. Just 15% of Republicans did. Independents were somewhere in the middle. About 36% of them trusted the media. That means we have an awful lot of work to do. And even more profoundly, a lot of people just don't know who we are. We live in your community, but we aren't making a point of introducing ourselves. And I think the project speaks to that.
If I could tack on to that, just a couple of days ago, I went to a Women for Trump event in Lakewood Ranch in Manatee County. And the speaker up there, a fine gentleman from New Zealand, I'm sure he's not very representative of your home island there, Matthew, was talking about the infiltration of Marxists in the media. And one of the things that he really talked about is he can't trust the media. And you hear murmurs of, you know, approval going through the crowd. And afterwards, when I talked to a couple of people there, you know, I told him I worked for the NPR affiliate, and they kind of looked at me a little askance. Mm-hmm. But once I told them what I was looking for, I wanted to get their take on the issues, they really opened up. And you get that one-on-one feeling with people. You get away from what other people are saying, which may or not be true. And you just get that heart-to-heart conversation. That's really what we're trying to do here.
Did you get the sense, Steve, too, that, you know, when people look askance at you, when the name NPR comes up, or even sort of public radio, do they listen? Or is it just sort of a notion that they have without being necessarily aware of what it is that public radio stations do, to kind of to Mary's point, like trying to reach new audiences there?
Well, I think it's safe to say if they look at me askance when I say I'm with an NPR affiliate, they probably don't listen. You know, anybody who listens knows that we try to get all sides of the issue here, and some people might think we're veering a little bit this way or a little bit that way. But, yeah, I'm sure most of them who have that opinion are informed by one particular cable outlet or their Twitter feed or whatever they're looking at online. That's kind of an echo chamber, and we're trying to get away from that.
Mm-hmm. Right. One thing that I heard recently that really stuck with me is only 21% of Americans have ever been interviewed by a journalist or met a journalist. And for people of color, it's so many fewer people have actually had those conversations. And that means we're not doing our job. And I think this project is giving us the opportunity to step into the community and have the time to listen. And Steve spent a whole day just down there listening, talking to folks. That's what we're going to be doing as part of I4 Votes, from St. Petersburg to Daytona Beach and in Orlando. We're going to be reaching out and just listening. Sometimes it may not be a story, but it's going to help shape our coverage. And I think that's what's most important.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty, talking to Steve Newborn and Mary Sheddon from WUSF and 90.7's Abe Abariah. Abe, I'm wondering what your perspective is on kind of trying to reframe that narrative, or maybe talk to folks who might have one opinion of the media in general, or an opinion about NPR and public radio, and what happens when you actually sit down and have that conversation.
I have definitely found in my experience that with a lot of people, if you start from a, you know, perspective of, hey, I'm a reporter, I want to talk to you about the issues that matter to you, and just sort of get your opinion on things, you know, a lot of times personally, I've had 10, 15, 20 minute conversations with people that kind of delve all the way off into topics that unfortunately we just don't have time to get into on air. But it is very interesting to talk to people and see what's sort of forming their opinions and what is leading them towards one issue over another. And a lot of times it kind of comes to these sort of pocketbook issues. You know, you hear that from politicians a lot, but for a lot of people, where rubber kind of hits the road, to borrow a metaphor for politics, is how much, you know, money they're putting into their taxes and their paycheck, or mm-hmm. into their health insurance premiums, or how much they, you know, I can't tell you the number of people who are just frustrated because, you know, like, I have insurance and yet I have such a high deductible that, you know, it feels like I don't. And, you know, any kind of medical procedure or doctor's appointment is coming out of my paycheck and not just out of a premium. So for a lot of people, you know, it just seems like when you talk to people, almost everyone I talk to is worried about what the preconceived notion of them is, mm-hmm. that they feel like they have been put into one box or another by the media or by reporters or, you know, by polling or something to that effect. And most people are so much more nuanced than that. Most people are not pulling a lever and, you know, checking one box of a party versus the other box. You know, most people cross aisles on different issues depending on what it is. And then it's just a matter of what's most important to me.
Right. There's some angst going into the ballot box for sure. And some of the issues you're dealing with, I mean, it's not just healthcare, right? Like you focused on the issue of gun rights and regulation for the story that you reported with Steve. I mean, is that something that, that people kind of hold pretty close? Do you sort of get the sense when you talk to them that they're really wrestling over these things, or are they just sort of set in stone?
I think this is one of those issues that guns in particular, it's very much, at least in my view, it's kind of a lifestyle question. You know, a lot of people, if you grew up with around guns and grew up shooting guns, you know, you have experience with them, and they're not, you know, a scary foreign thing. But if your experience with them is maybe different, then you're going to have a different opinion. And so for, you know, the gun question in particular, I spoke with a gentleman who had gone through the military and had been that was a very important issue to him. And then Parkland happened and he has kids in high school, and it just kind of hit him at home. Like, this is something that really needs to be dealt with, not just in Florida, but, you know, on a broader level. And so that was one of the reasons why he was having trouble supporting Trump. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there are people who this is something that's kind of part of their identity. And you know, they say, look, Second Amendment doesn't say what kind of gun, doesn't get into civilian weapons versus military weapons. It doesn't get into any of that. It's just I have a right to bear arms, and that is fundamentally important to me, and it's in our founding document. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you end up kind of talking to people, you get a sense of not just what issues matter to them, but why they matter to them and why it's important.
And Matt, speaking to Abe's point, I really think that's the heart of why this project is so important, is that we're talking about intensely emotional issues. Guns, gun rights versus gun control, abortion, you know, pro-life versus pro-choice, and healthcare. I mean, we are talking about, to some people, matters of life and death. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it is so important that we journalists are listening and listening to you about what is involved in that decision making, asking the questions of the candidates on your behalf so that you can get the answers, because it is so the emotion, you know, we in public media like to take out the screaming and the yelling at each other and really give thought and time to it. And I think that's what this collaboration speaks to.
Right. And I think the sort of the long view of the collaboration too, the fact that we are not just kind of dipping into it, we're not just covering a primary or the election and the couple of weeks around that, we are taking a year-long, maybe longer approach to this. And I sort of feel like when you listen to some of the folks that we've heard from already as part of the i4Votes collaboration, Steve, in particular, I'm thinking about the young man that you interviewed who one of the big issues he was talking about was immigration. You could kind of hear him sort of teasing through these knotty issues, right? I mean, they aren't cut and dried. He's kind of thinking out loud and sort of thinking through things as he thinks about the decision he's going to be making come November.
Yeah, he was definitely wrestling with this issue. The reason we picked up this issue is because our survey basically said that for most Republicans, immigration tops the list. So when I talked to him, he's a student at the University of South Florida, fairly young guy. He's not even sure he's going to vote for Trump, even though he identifies as a Republican. He basically said, I agree with a lot of the immigration proposals that are going on, but he's totally against the wall. He thinks that's counterproductive, and he believes in, you know, kind of a merit-based immigration policy where we invite people in who have maybe higher education, have skills the country needs. But he's not wedded to any of this. You could kind of hear him hemming and hawing when he was answering, which is good because, you know, it's nice to have an open mind and be able to change your mind as the facts change.
Right. And although, of course, we are trying to get to the heart of the issues, in some ways it is about personalities, right? I mean, you kind of talked about that a little bit, Steve, talking about the kickoff of this election cycle and that big rally you went to. I mean, the personality of the president does loom pretty large, even on the Democratic side when you look at some of the candidates there too. Sometimes it is about the personalities and people aligning with, you know, somebody who they feel kind of represents the way they feel about things.
Oh, yeah. And the surveys that I physically had filled out in Lakeland, They almost everyone said Donald Trump was one of their big concerns. Either they want to keep him or they want to make him a one-termer. Mm-hmm. So Trump is kind of like the sun that all the political planets orbit around. He's the big issue. A lot of people are basing their vote on whether they're the best candidates that can get Trump out of office. Mm-hmm. I interviewed a canvasser for Elizabeth Warren. It was a couple of weeks ago before she dropped out. And she was lamenting the fact that even though a lot of people liked what she was saying and liked Elizabeth Warren's stances on a lot of the issues, they were voting strategically, is the word she used. They were voting strategically on which candidate would be the better one to oust Trump in November.
Mm-hmm. Mary Shedden, we are not just partnering up our two stations here along the I-4 corridor, right? We're also part of a bigger network. This is part of something called America Amplified, really trying to talk to real people leading up to the election. I wonder if you could just explain a little bit about what America Amplified is trying to achieve here.
Sure. The project, which is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is taking all the things that we've been talking about and really focusing on getting away from the preconceived ideas and putting people at the center of reporting. And that can be at listening events or public forums or crowdsourcing or the polls we did. But the whole idea is to get the voices from America that haven't been heard. And we're talking about places like Pennsylvania, Ohio Valley, which is rural West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee, the New England News Collaborative, so the whole New England, small communities in New England. And it's the Mountain West News Bureau, which is out in Colorado and the smaller parts of the West.
Right. Yeah, we heard from some young voters in Nevada as well, right?
Correct. Correct. And those stories are just talking to people. And these and we've talked to the stories from across America are asking the exact same questions that we're asking here at I4 Votes. And we're going to be sharing them with the audience, both online and on air, so that we're talking today about our neighbors along the I-4 corridor, and we really are truly neighbors. But this is neighbors across the country. And the fact is that all of us are wrestling with these questions as the election looms.
Mm-hmm. Mary, how do you think you will be able to measure if the project has been a success?
It's really about you, the person who's listening here. We will not have done our job if we are not having the conversations with you, and whether that's meeting you in person at some of the events that we're going to be putting on along the corridor, or on our Facebook pages, or on our Twitter handle even, I4 Votes. We truly, truly want to talk with you and hear what's important. That may be criticism. That may be compliments. I get them both all the time as a news director, and I appreciate it. And we want to hear from you. And it's so critical. And this collaboration will not succeed if you listening, you hearing, seeing something online, if you, my neighbors, are not responding, we haven't done our job.
We've been talking about the I4 Votes collaboration with Mary Shedden. She is the news director at WUSF. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you, Matt.
Also joined by WUSF's political reporter, Steve Newborn. Steve, thanks as well.
It's been a pleasure.
And 90.7's Abe Abariah. Abe, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, the importance of the Florida primary in the race for the Democratic nomination. We check in with political commentators Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Former Vice President Joe Biden's delegate lead over Senator Bernie Sanders is widening in the Democratic primary. A lot of delegates are still up for grabs, though, and Sanders is staying in the race. Florida holds its primary on Tuesday, so what's at stake for the two leading candidates in the Sunshine State? Well, Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic state representative and founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group, and Frank Torres, Republican political analyst. You can find his writing about Central Florida politics and more over at OrlandoOpinion.com. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with a recent poll from the Florida Atlantic University Business and Economics Polling Initiative. It found that Joe Biden had a sizable lead over Bernie Sanders in the state of Florida, and in a statement, Monica Escaleras, the director of the FAU BEPI, said that Florida has been a strong Biden firewall state since we started polling a year ago, end quote. Dick Batchelor, does that pretty much sum up accurately the state of Florida as far as Democrats are concerned?
Yes, you know, Florida has 219 delegate votes. It's a delegate-rich state that goes without saying, and it's very critical. I mean, not only that, but also if you get the nominee, you get the delegate votes in Florida, it obviously bodes well for you as some indicator on the general election. Because it's going to be a very, very close race. Keep in mind, in 2016, Andrew Gillum lost the governor's race by, I think, 0.3 of a point, right? And so it's a very, very close, very, very close race against DeSantis,
right,
who is a very strong candidate. So in Florida, as far as the general election, is extraordinarily important because it is a swing state because of the margins are so tight now, number one. Number two, there's a very large African-American population in Florida, probably about 18 to 20% in most counties. In Broward County, for instance, 38% of the Democratic vote is African-American. So it's really, really critical. And that I-4 corridor is always a predictor. So,
right.
I mean, there's going to be – when they make it to the general election, if it's Biden and Trump, there's going to be an extraordinary amount of money spent into Florida.
Frank, thinking about polls, though, how much faith do you place in polls in 2020?
Normally, I don't place any faith in polls. I mean, these things have been wrong for the last couple of years. But I think in this particular instance, when you see the numbers in the polls and you can match it up to what you see what happening in the streets and what you see happening with the different Democratic organizations, I think you have a match here. I think Joe Biden has really put in the work, especially here in the Orlando area. He's been a regular visitor to the area, whether it's been campaigning for Hillary Clinton in 2016 or for various Democratic candidates throughout the years. And he's also held a couple of, you know, fundraisers here. And you'll recall just over the past weekend, Jill Biden made a couple stops right here in Orlando. What you see is one campaign really trying to earn the support and get out front here in the Sunshine State, while his competitor Bernie Sanders is spending his time in other states.
And, may I follow up on that point?
Sure.
To agree with, not to make him nervous, but to agree with him. But then that is Congressman Darren Soto endorsed, Stephanie Murphy, who had been with Bloomberg, endorsed.
Yeah, Val Stephanie Demings, endorses everybody.
Val Demings endorsed. Not only that, she's on the short list to be considered as a maybe a running mate. That does not hurt when you're looking at the presidential primary in Florida on the 17th, particularly in the I-4 corridor, that you're talking about the possibility, at least entertaining, Val Demings as your running mate. So that was a brilliant stroke on his part.
Let's just think a little bit and unpack that notion of local endorsements then. I mean, Frank, you were talking about the fact that Joe Biden has been in Central Florida. He's been a fairly, you know, well-known figure here in local races with his endorsements of candidates here. And then you have that payback, right? I mean, U.S. Representative Darren Soto, Val Demings, as we said, Stephanie Murphy, throwing their lot behind Biden. But thinking about Stephanie Murphy, she'd already endorsed a couple of other former candidates, Beto O'Rourke and then Michael Bloomberg, for his short-lived, very expensive campaign. I'm wondering, Frank, what that tells you about the merits or not of endorsing early in a presidential primary with such a crowded field.
And listen, I feel bad, you know, dunking on Stephanie here when I warn she's a very nice person. But the first endorsement was early. Beto O'Rourke, who's her friend, and helped her on a campaign trail in 2018. And then after that, after Beto got out, Mike Bloomberg, which was considered, you know, was kind of a head scratcher. And then,
but in line with the likes of, you know, Mayor Buddy Dyer, of course.
Yeah,
so,
but and then you'd see you saw Buddy Dyer jump on to the Bloomberg campaign less than 24 hours before Bloomberg fell on his face on Super Tuesday, and everybody ended up in the Joe Biden camp anyway. So I think, you know, I think it pays to wait on these endorsements, and I think that's where Darren Soto and Val Demings got it right, and everybody else got it wrong.
And to that point, too, if you look at the strategy that Joe Biden is using, I mean, my email blows up every day with everybody who's endorsed. I think everybody's endorsed, you know, Biden at the key level, and he rolls them out in the right way. He rolls them out, you know, daily and very strong, particularly the former presidential candidates endorsing him, getting on board. So I think those endorsements carry some currency, particularly now, because you're seeing the former governor, the current governors, former U.S. senators getting in line behind Joe Biden as opposed to Bernie Sanders, because they're basically trying to move the middle lane over. So I think endorsements can help, but if you've endorsed more than one time, I guess you lose some value.
That's right. And let's not make any mistake here. Everybody, including myself to an extent, thought Joe Biden was gone. I mean, there was a remarkable comeback in South Carolina. If he hadn't gotten South Carolina, then, you know, who knows if we'd even be talking about him today. We might be talking about Mike Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders. We might be just talking about Bernie Sanders. But these endorsements were just ill-timed, and, you know, it really brings into question the entire process.
But the interesting thing about that, too, is you're right. After Iowa and then after New Hampshire, he's in, like, fifth place. And I can just hold on to South Carolina. If I could just hold on, people, you're number one, you can't hold on. Number two, you don't have enough money to get a Super Tuesday. Well, after Clyburn endorsed him, I mean, he's got to give Clyburn, he's got to kiss his ring every day, because Clyburn delivered South Carolina, and when the black votes delivered every other state that he won in, go look at the numbers, and that's why he's counting on so much and so strongly the African-American vote, because it is so strong. But Clyburn, you got to go back and give him credit. He resuscitated Joe Biden, and in the next 72 hours, he raised $17 million online.
Well, he hadn't actually spent much in the states that he did pretty well.
Well,
right?
I think in Massachusetts, he never went there and never spent any money. In Virginia, I think he spent $4,000. And again, the young Bernie bros did not turn out in most of these states as they did the last time he ran for president. The numbers are way down. They're very committed to him, but they're not turning out and voting. And what's happening is African-American vote is up. So they're basically crushing the Bernie bros as far as the hardliners who are supporting Bernie. So, again, Clyburn resuscitated that whole campaign.
Sure, but isn't it – I mean, you want to be careful you don't kind of pigeonhole the two camps too much. I mean, there are African-American supporters of Bernie Sanders.
Oh, sure.
Like, not every Bernie bro is what you might think when you think of the term Bernie bro, right?
Right. No, he's got African-American support, but it's minimal and not enough.
What about turnout, though? I mean, thinking about what happened on Super Tuesday, does that give you any indication of what turnout might be looking ahead to Florida?
Well, I want to say yes and no, but that sounds awfully political, doesn't it? Because yes, it does, because the momentum is there. But if depending on who's still in the race by the time you get to Florida, it will – people might just say, look, it's a foregone conclusion. I'm not going to go vote. Now, a number of people have voted absentee in early voting, which is good. But, again, I think it really
depends. For candidates who may, well, not be in the race anymore.
That's exactly right. And if that's the case, you might just say, why go vote? And there's I got choice A or choice A.
Frank, what do you think about turnout?
You know, I think both parties, and we're seeing it specifically because this is a Democratic primary, are still trying to unlock the mystery of the younger voters. The younger voters still aren't turning out the way I think some of these candidates would like to see, especially Bernie Sanders, and it's showing in the results. And, you know, you're trying to pick up influencers. You're trying to hit certain parts of the media equation to try to get younger voters excited about the election, and it just isn't happening. And these younger voters can play a very important part of the general election here in November. So you had a lot of consultants, a lot of political operatives trying to figure out this puzzle of trying to get our younger voters motivated, and they just haven't figured it out yet.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty, talking to political analysts Dick Batchelor and Frank Torres, looking ahead to the Florida primary next week. Just kind of thinking a little more about Florida, there's been quite a bit of speculation about the impact of Bernie Sanders' comments in the media about Cuba. Frank, what do you make of that? Is that sort of justified, some of that concern?
You know, I think one of Bernie Sanders' greatest strengths and one of his greatest weaknesses is that he's real. And he, with those comments about Fidel Castro and praising that regime in regards to education, I believe hit a lot of voters on both sides the wrong way, including Democratic representatives who who went on the record and slammed those comments.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about that particular part of history and that particular part of the world and how it relates to Florida, then you need to understand the way people feel down here before you go on 60 Minutes and try to, you know, and really try to voice your opinions on mm-hmm. that.
So, Dick Batchelor, is Cuba still kind of a third rail for politicians in Florida? I mean, thinking about the kind of outcry you had from Democrats in Florida when the media was focused on those comments that Bernie Sanders had made on 60 Minutes, I mean, is that still something that voters, whether they're Cuban-American or Florida voters in general, is that still something that's really top of mind for voters, or is that are we placing too much emphasis on that?
I'd say generationally it makes a big difference even in the Cuban community. Some of the newer generations, Cuban-Americans, are going, okay, maybe Bob, they don't, but the old line Cuban community, and Frank maybe can speak to this more intelligently than I can, but it's still emblematic. Keep in mind, it's the optics of it all. You go, anytime you have to go back and apologize for being apologetic on behalf of a communist regime, you've turned a conversation to where you don't want to go, but mm-hmm. the Republicans want you to go. They want you to go there. So, yeah, from a campaign issue standpoint, yeah, it makes a big difference, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the diversity of the field of candidates. It was a very diverse field at the start of the race, very crowded too. Now it's not. Dick Batchelor, does that tell you something about the state of the Democratic Party, or is it just kind of a comment on the politics that we're in at this moment in time?
Well, as an old guy, let me so I've got somebody in my lane now, right? The whole process, the nominating process, obviously, I think if you go back and look at it, the debates carry a lot of weight. As evidence, I'm going to go back to the Bloomberg. Bloomberg spent, what, $600 million. He mm-hmm. spent about almost like $100 million per delegate or whatever it equated to.
Which
right?
is still just a fraction of his fortune.
Over $60 billion fortune.
It's mind-blowing.
But keep in mind, and he spent all that money, but people went back to the debate. That first debate, he never recovered from. And the second one, he was like, okay, but that's not good enough when you're on stage with seasoned debaters that had been on the stage before. So I think the earned media, when you're out there debating and doing press conferences and doing rallies and all, and that earned media shows the value, and then particularly on the social media sites too. So that's encouraging to me as somebody who's opposed to Citizens United case, where you can spend an unlimited amount of money as a corporation, but it's encouraging to me to note that free media, earned media, where you're out there, has more value in this case than did the, you know, the paid media of $600 million. But also on I just think people are been pushed to the right and then pushed to the left, and then finally they took a deep breath and said, "I don't want to be either one. I really want to get back to the middle." So I think you see people rushing back to the middle, and that's what happens after a primary. Democrats run left, Republicans run right. You try to get back to the middle to appeal to the middle. So what's happening now within the Democratic Party pre-general election is people, the campaign nominees, mm-hmm. or at least one of them, is trying to take people back to the middle. That seems to be very appealing to the voters.
And getting back to your point about diversity, I think if you're on the Democratic ticket, the running mate needs to be somebody, potentially somebody of color, potentially a female.
It's got to be a female.
You can't talk diversity and then move forward with a ticket that doesn't mm-hmm. reflect the diversity of your movement.
And is that a lesson learned from 2016?
I don't think it's so much a lesson learned at all. I think it's more of an answer of the conscience. Mm-hmm. I think you have to practice what you preach. And we hear so much about diversity and the importance of equality all around, then, you know, you have to make sure that you're reflecting that in the way you live and the way you run your campaign for president.
Frank Torrey is Republican political analyst. You can find his writing about Central Florida politics and more over at OrlandoOpinion.com. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
And Dick Batchelor, former Democratic state representative, founder of the Dick Batchelor Management Group, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, a conversation with former U.S. Representative and former candidate for Florida Governor Gwen Graham, who's endorsed Joe Biden in the Democratic presidential primary. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Senator Bernie Sanders had a disappointing night in Tuesday's Democratic primaries, where former Vice President Joe Biden's victories widened the delegate gap between the two candidates. Still, in a speech he gave from his hometown of Burlington, Vermont, on Wednesday, Sanders said his campaign is winning the ideological debate and that he's looking forward to debating Biden in person this weekend. Let's hear from one of Biden's high-profile supporters in Florida, Gwen Graham, who he reached by phone as she was about to get on a plane at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. Well, Gwen Graham is a former U.S. representative and former Democratic candidate for Florida governor. She has endorsed Joe Biden in the Democratic presidential primary. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you today.
So what is it about Joe Biden that makes you think he's the candidate for the Democratic Party this time around?
On day one, when the vice president announced that he was running for president, I supported him because I know he is the candidate that can beat Donald Trump on November 3rd, 2020. And my focus has been very much targeted on Florida. I know that he's the candidate that can build the winning coalition across the state that will put Florida in the D column on November 3rd and will deny Donald Trump reelection. It is wonderful to see the rest of the country is also coming to that same conclusion as we have moved through the primaries. And last night was another wonderful night for the vice president. And I'm looking forward to the primary in Florida next Tuesday. And I'm sure that Florida is going to give the vice president another big win and add more delegates to his already large lead. And we're moving towards the convention and making sure that we're all united and have the focus of beating Donald Trump. And that's what I know not only in Florida, but across the country we need to do.
Is that the takeaway from other primaries? I'm sort of wondering if that is the biggest thing that you think is motivating people to get out and vote. I mean, whether it's North Carolina, South Carolina, other primaries that Joe Biden has won pretty substantially. Is it that and the fact that people believe he can assemble that coalition rather than, you know, his policies per se?
100%. I mean, I think that Donald Trump is the greatest incentive to exercise our right to vote so that we can make sure that he is not reelected. And the coalition that the vice president is building is exactly the coalition that we are going to need to win Florida on November 3rd. And it's what I saw from the very beginning, was that he was the candidate that could do that. And I do think that's an incentive, but I also think people are really looking forward to having a president again that we can be proud of, and a president that unites our country instead of divides our country. A president that you have confidence in is going to have policies that are protecting our country. I think we are all living now with the outcome of having a president that disbanded much of our health infrastructure and now is trying to play catch-up in dealing with the coronavirus as it spreads across our country and in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. But I also think, Matthew, that there are other issues that people are very concerned about, health care being one of them, and making sure that we have access to health care, building on the Affordable Care Act, which is what the vice president has committed to doing. And so there are not just the desire to defeat Trump, but to have a functional federal government again under the vice president, and he knows how to do it. On day one, he can come in and start fixing the mess that Trump has created, not only within our federal government, but restore our standing internationally, which is also very important.
Do you think there is some irony in that, though, Gwen Graham, that you're talking about healthcare as, you know, one of the important sort of pillars of his campaign,
yes.
and that is something that Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, has campaigned on from, you know, for years. That has been his platform. That is what people have galvanized his supporters around that. So you think that he doesn't have what it takes to sort of bring voters out and sort of push through policies that would make people's lives better?
Well, the results of the primaries to date have proven that it is the vice president that has the ability to galvanize voters and get them out to the polls, which is what we need to do on November 3rd. And, you know, the Medicare for All proposals that Senator Sanders has been supportive of are just not going to be practical in terms of being implemented. And what the vice president has committed to doing and what I committed to doing as well when I was in Congress, was working to expand the Affordable Care Act so that we do provide coverage for Americans who desperately need it and who, during a crisis, we're all very aware how important it is to have quality health care. Mm-hmm. It's hitting home now in a way that, unfortunately, who would have predicted? I mean, it's not something we ever want to have happen to our country, but we're dealing with the impact of a spread of a virus that's very scary. Mm-hmm. And reinforces the need for quality health care for all Americans.
Gwen Graham, just thinking back to the crowd of candidates we had at the start of the primary run, it was pretty diverse. I wonder what thoughts you have about the fact that we are now down to two candidates and it doesn't look a lot different from previous elections. Is that disappointing?
Well, obviously, I would love to have a woman president. Quite frankly, Hillary Clinton, she won the popular vote and would have been a phenomenal president. And this is what the voters have decided upon. I mean, this is the process that we've gone through. I was really proud of our field of Democratic candidates. We had an abundance of riches. And now I'm thrilled that we've come down to what appears to be an insurmountable lead that the vice president has, and he will be our Democratic nominee. And I know he will pick a phenomenal vice presidential candidate that will also be able to help restore the soul of our country and put our country back on the right path again after four disastrous years of Donald Trump.
Do you think the vice presidential pick, is that the kind of key to you know, reaching out to people who would like to see a woman or a person of color in the White House?
I certainly would advise that he pick a woman. I think that would be important for the country to have a woman vice president. I think that's a significant step. But I am, again, that is the campaign's decision to make, and I know they'll pick the best person to help lead with Joe Biden. I think one of the things that was very critical during the 8 years of President Obama was that he did have a strong vice president by his side who was helping him lead. And that relationship is critically important. And particularly, there's going to be so much that needs to be done because of the disaster that Donald Trump has been, which is indicated in what we're going through right now with the coronavirus. I mean, he dismantled so much of the response team for a pandemic of this nature that now we're having to start all over, and it's resulting in deaths, and it's resulting in us being way behind in being able to get tests ready, be able to have people on the ground to help prevent further spreading of this disease. And another example of the damage that Donald Trump has done to our country. And we're seeing in real time every single day.
Right. And, of course, if you talk to Trump supporters, they will have a totally different take on that. And I'm sure they're going to be energized in November as well and ready to get out and vote, too. So,
well, I'll tell you what the difference will be in Florida, in my opinion, and across the country, is the coalition that the vice president will be able to build will be one that brings in all different idea along the ideological spectrum of Democratic voters. Independents will come out and vote for the vice president, and there will be a large number of Republicans who will put country over party and recognize that the vice president is someone that they can trust and that they can believe in and they can be comfortable voting for. And in the suburban areas, what's been seen to date is that the numbers that are coming out to vote in the Democratic primary is significant, huge, doubling the amount previously in 2016. That is an incredible sign that on November 3rd, there's going to be a turnout like we've never seen before to make sure that we do not reelect Donald Trump. And so women, I'll just say that women are appalled that the example that Donald Trump is setting is one that is embarrassing for our country and for future generations of Americans. And so I do know that women, suburban women, many of whom voted for Donald Trump in 2016, will not be voting for him in 2020 and will be voting for the vice president.
Right. I mean,
we're going to win Florida, Matthew. We're going to win Florida.
To that point, I mean, there are some women who are sticking by Donald Trump, but I guess we'll have to get through the primaries first and then see what happens in November.
Well, the numbers, there certainly are, but the numbers will not be as significant as they were in 2016. There's going to be many, much like what happened in 2018, where we saw women crossing over to vote for particularly women congressional candidates. And that's why we saw the flip in the House of Representatives. The flip was red congressional districts that went blue because women were coming out to send a message that we want to have more considerate, more empathetic, more leadership that we can be proud of as examples for the future generations. I mean, that's incredibly – I've had many presidents in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I've never had one. It didn't matter what party the president was of. I knew that they put our country first, that they were presidents that I could be proud of. That is not the case with Donald Trump.
Well, Gwen Graham, former U.S. representative and former Democratic candidate for Florida governor and a supporter of Joe Biden in the Democratic presidential primary. We've been speaking to her at Washington, D.C.'s National Airport.
Very noisy airport.
Thank you so much for joining us, Gwen Graham. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate it.
And a note, we did reach out to the Sanders campaign in Florida and asked to speak to a surrogate, and that invitation still stands. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seely. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.